today, Monday, March 4th, Los Angeles, LA podcast. If the mics sound a little different, they were used for an exciting purpose yesterday. Alyssa's children's preschool, or just your daughter's preschool.
Well, soon that will be all my children.
Had a auction, charity auction, and who used these mics?
The Ukulele Orchestra of the Western Hemisphere.
Oh. I mean, whole hemisphere.
The entire hemisphere. They were so good.
Yeah, I would hope so.
You haven't seen them?
It's actually quite a large
ukulele ensemble. And they played the most killer cover of Tusk.
Oh,
which
that's
you
cool.
have never imagined until yeah. you have seen it on ukuleles.
Are they just like jamming out with the ukuleles?
So good, yeah.
Does anyone have any LA story? That doesn't have to be your LA story.
I think that pretty much covers that's my it. Week. That was
your week.
The end of an exciting week for me.
I don't have anything.
So here's just a little. I was reading on Twitter, Alex Perrine, Alyssa, your former Gawker Media Group co-worker. I don't know if you guys ever met. He was talking about something that people are saying a lot more recently, which is that city police departments have basically become de facto social workers, and a lot of their budget should be funneled towards actual social workers who are more equipped to intervene with people who are homeless and things like that. And I started thinking about, in LA, I know a lot of that intervention is done by firefighters, especially downtown. I know there's a Skid Row fire station that is like really, really busy. So I decided to look up the numbers on that, and I found a press release from Fire Station 9 downtown from the LA Fire Department. And it said the Fire Station 9 is the busiest fire station in the country, according to a new national survey. Guess how many call-outs they do every year? This was for 2017.
600.
I actually have no baseline expectation for what would be a lot.
33,380.
Well, that's definitely a lot.
That's
like two a day.
I know.
Every day they get 33,000. Every day they get called out 91 times.
Wow.
What?
And they're not fighting fires.
That's wild.
That's not what they're going out there to do. They're doing like overdose response, like emergency medical response for people who live in Skid Row.
That's incredible.
And it makes you wonder, like, things like the LA Fire Department has traditionally been very restrictive about who they hire, their hiring practices. I mean, like, in general, compared to the police department, when they actually do emergency services, they're very effective. There's usually not any like problems there because they can't arrest people.
Right.
But
nobody dies.
Yes.
Because of their intervention.
Yes. But the department is 3% female. And that's because when you try out to be a firefighter, you have to do all these tests of strength. You have to run around with a big hose and stuff like that, which is not what a big part of the job is anymore, especially at a fire station like this. So you hear the conversation being about police departments a lot, but you wonder what would happen if we took even the same people that are working as firefighters and just said, hey, you don't have to wear the big suit anymore. You don't have to wear the hat. You guys are now more like emergency social workers.
Right.
And if they could be trained differently and more effectively for the things that they're actually doing. I was just stunned by how big that number is. 91 callouts every single day for that fire department. Really. Lot of news this week. Let's start with
preventable disease.
Whooping cough is back.
It's back.
Private school whooping cough. How do you say it? Now that it's coming out of my mouth, I'm saying it weird. Whooping?
I think whooping.
Whooping cough?
I mean, you can say it however you want.
Hooping.
Hooping? 30 kids at Harvard Westlake, the most prestigious private school in the city, Mayor Garcetti's alma mater, have recently gotten whooping cough. Mm-hmm. It's going all over the city.
You could also call it pertussis.
I like
if you
that.
Want to disavoid.
I like that less. Yeah. I don't like that as much. and it's spreading all over the county. This is something that's really going around, and it's mostly something that affects kids and teens, I think. Although there is a vaccination that you get. When do you get your first?
You start getting them when you're probably like one, maybe even smaller.
And you get a booster.
You get a booster, yeah.
What's interesting to me about this is I don't think I've ever, like, it does happen that kids get it from time to time. I don't think I've ever really heard of an outbreak among teenagers is what's interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, yeah. It just seems like something that normally happens. You got kids, they're running around, you can't really control
their
contact or whatever, but...
Well,
people do get vaccinated, so it just seems interesting that this is happening.
Well, so this is the question, Scott. Do people get vaccinated? because LA, I think, is kind of seen as a place... I see articles kind of pop up every now and then about how LA is this kind of bastion of not getting your kids vaccinated. It's not as bad as Orange County or the Pacific Northwest in terms of ostensibly liberal people who don't believe in
science.
Keeping kids healthy in science. Yes.
I don't know. Yeah, this feels like a moment where we have to, in order to like parse the Angelino psyche, we are expected to invoke some kind of Joan Didion or Chandler quote that we could use to sort of say how weird it is that we're all living out here on the end of the world or something.
But there was that amazing Hollywood Reporter story maybe a few years ago that looked at the vaccination rates on West Side schools particularly. Yeah.
Yes.
And it was matching them to like parts of like African communities that did not have access to vaccinations.
Yeah.
That's the rate of protection against these preventable diseases.
And a lot of these kids who go to Harvard Westlake, not to stereotype, do live on the West Side. But we passed in California, we passed a law now a couple years ago that was supposed to change vaccination rates. Basically, so this was Senate Bill 277. It got rid of the personal belief exemption. Before that, you could just say basically, no, thank you. I don't believe in needles.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't give your kid a vaccination. Now you can't do that anymore. And so I just want to look at the numbers and see how vaccination rates have changed in California. And they have gone up. They've gone up a pretty substantial amount. In the 2015-2016 school year, the rate was 92.8%. And in 2017-2018, it was 95.1%.
Okay.
And when it comes to herd immunity, that's pretty good. Like that's basically cutting the people that aren't getting vaccinated almost in half. At the same time, medical exemptions have gone way up. So the people that are really militant about this, about not getting kids vaccinated, are basically
finding the right doctor. Who will write?
So that was my next question. It was like, who are these doctors who are writing these medical exemptions? It feels like what you hear about the opioid crisis. How there are a handful of doctors that are prescribing huge, huge numbers of these.
Yeah,
pills.
I mean there are doctors that a popular thing that I hear as a parent is there are doctors that will like spread out your vaccination schedule more because a lot of the belief against vaccinations are that getting a lot of these at once is what's going to damage your child.
Huh.
So there, I do know, and I do hear people talk about saying, oh, well, you know, our doctor has this like relaxed schedule when it comes to vaccinations. And I don't know if that
doctor.
Yeah. Cool guy.
I wonder if this is where Dr. Kush on Venice Beach, as that business dried up, now it's time to get it to vaccination exemptions.
But I'm sure you could find plenty of doctors in the LA area that will agree with you.
So you're saying you didn't want to vaccinate your children. Doctors will spread out the vaccination schedule so as basically to make it ineffective.
Maybe when you're a teenager, you still don't have your final booster or something. I don't know. I don't know how that would affect it.
That you just go in every month for a different shot.
It feels like it when you're a baby, when you have a baby, right? Every like 3 or 4 months, you're going in and getting like another round of vaccinations to protect your child. And then you do get them like pretty much every year until you're like, you know, 5, 6, 7, and even for certain things when you are teenagers. Yeah.
But you wouldn't need a medical exemption for that necessarily, right? For like the relaxed schedule. As long as you're getting them, if you're not getting them on the same day, that's okay. I guess if you were spraying out across years.
Yeah, I don't know if a doctor is going to make you do that.
Right.
I think if you once you want to try to register in a school or some other kind of situation, that's when
they check.
You
got to
hand, you got to hand this thing over when your kid goes to like a camp or like a school.
Yeah,
that shows that you're up to date. So
it's interesting. So the 95% that you're talking about, is that where? What is that? What catchment area is that? State?
California,
all
state,
the state
of California.
So it's interesting because it is like that. I think that 95% level is what roughly you need in order to maintain the sort of herd immunity. But then again, that's a very large, that's not like a community level.
Yes.
So if you look at the people sending their kids to Harvard Westlake, I wonder what we would see as far as the percentage vaccinated.
If that subzone has more opt-outs.
More opt-outs, yeah. I really do feel like the anti-vaxxer, whatever you want to call it, that group of people, that really is just like a completely vicious ideology that, like, you know, I'm going to not going to vaccinate my child against preventable diseases. They're going to be in danger. Other people are going to be in danger. And I'm going to do that either because, like, I think that the government is like trying to mind control them, or because I think that they could get autism, which is, you know, a condition that people live with every day and is not a reason why you should endanger your child's
but
life.
But also you're not suggesting that they actually will get autism from
I'm not.
From the vaccines.
But what I'm saying is,
even if they did.
Yes. Even if they did, that is not an excuse. But yes, of course, there is no actual link between vaccinations and autism. I just think it is despicable to use that as a justification for anti-vaxxer.
Someone I follow on Twitter, Steve Silberman, writes a lot about, you know, autism and all these different issues that are facing, you know, especially like the anti-vaccination crowd. And he said, wouldn't it be amazing if we had, instead of spending all this time trying to combat these lies, basically, about vaccinations, that people would have devoted this energy to talk about how to make sure that people with autism are integrated and accepted in society, instead of making it be like, this is the thing we're trying to stop at all costs, which is so terrifying.
Let's stay on the kids for a little bit. There's a big move in LAUSD this week. They've been talking about this for a few months to a year, but the LAUSD board finally put forward a motion to put a parcel tax on the June ballot. This is basically asking everyone who's a property owner in LA to pay 16 cents per square foot on the habitable indoor space of your home to go towards LAUSD schools. It would be in effect for 12 years. This would be something that they would make a significant amount of money on. This lack of funds is the biggest problem facing LAUSD. But historically, a lot of the emphasis has been on cuts rather than finding ways to get more money. So this seems like a positive move, although some people are upset, especially some UTLA members are upset because the money goes to charters as well as the bad blood between traditional public schools and charters continues. They don't think charters should get any of that money. This is some members of UTLA.
I mean, charters are the ones that exist are all part of LAUSD. So it would be interesting if they were to try to spend that money exclusively on traditional schools. I don't know. I feel like that would engender a lot of legal pushback.
And it's punishing kids.
Right.
You know, the kids do go to these charter schools.
Right. Like, exactly. I think the entire school district does need additional funding streams. So,
Yeah. There was a funny quote, and there's a LA Times article about it by Howard Bloom, the education reporter, and he quoted Richard Vladovic, the school board member, and he said, many people judge our schools. You waste money and the kids are loud. Then it says you don't know about the million miracles that occur at our schools every day, but I just like the idea that he's hearing all the time at school board meetings. Like, can you, these kids
is that
are
like the number one
loud.
Complaint against children you
wanna
give, globally.
You want me to give more tax money to these loud ass kids?
But this, I found this so like a very specific parcel tax.
16 cents.
Well, no, not 16 cents, but is it on like home renovations? Is
no,
this, like,
no, it's on everything. It's on.
I know, but like it specifically targets like home renovations to me. Like that's how I read it. Like if somebody wanted to, you know, fix their kitchen or add an extra bedroom, is this like something that you'd be charged extra for?
Oh yeah. Well, you would be charged if you add habitable space to your home.
That's
then
what
you're
I'm saying.
Then you're getting charged more. But
don't you think single family homeowners are going to be really against that?
They are absolutely going to be totally against it. They'll take their kids out of school and just set up a commune where they will all immediately get polio.
Right. They egg wash their babies instead of vaccinating them. Like a nice brioche. So that maybe explains the way that this is being structured. So it excludes properties that are owned as a primary residence by LA residents 65 or older.
Yeah.
Probably because they are less likely to have children in LAUSD, I would imagine.
I guess.
And that way they don't have to worry about them being staunchly opposed to
this. But it also applies to commercial buildings.
Well, that's fine because the commercial building thing could also be taken care of if we end up getting the ballot measure that's going to kind of reinstate them paying their proper share of taxes. When would that happen? 2020?
The Prop 13 partial repeal is, I believe, on the November 2020 ballot.
Okay, so that this could maybe go into effect before that, should it pass.
Right.
Okay.
More LAUSD board news. Monica Garcia has thrown her hat in the ring for the increasingly crowded city council District 14 race to replace Jose Huizar. So who's in that race now? Monica Garcia.
Kevin DeLeon.
Just those two.
Yeah.
Monica Garcia is an interesting figure in this race because she used to work for Jose Huizar.
Yeah.
She did an interview with LA Taco that I thought was interesting in its refusal to really engage with all the Huizar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
did you expect her to volunteer that she is intimately associated with his past dealings?
Right. But I do expect some people to start asking questions at some, because he's been doing sort of unseemly
allegedly
for a while, but it seems like this has been going on for kind of a long time. I mean, he was, I think, first investigated when he was on the LAUSD board in like 2003, and she was working for him in the mid 2000s. So,
and avoided investigation by the grace of somebody dying, basically.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. So, I guess that's an open question for her. It also kind of informs why I think a lot of people were surprised recently when she came out in favor of the ban on charter school expansion in the last couple of weeks, because she has historically been seen as one of the biggest proponents of charter schools in the city. So you wonder if that was part of sort of laying the groundwork for being, more bipartisan on that spectrum.
This is
laying the groundwork for a run.
Because every time we talk about this, I have people in my Twitter mentions telling me that things are not as black and white as we portray them.
As I
but
am
you've
saying
laid out
it,
that it
no,
is.
Like, as I'm saying it, I'm preparing for these people to get angry at me. But I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that Garcia historically has been friendlier to charter school expansion than certainly other members of the school board. And that a lot of people were surprised, including the thousands of charter school proponents who were protesting the ban and were upset when, as Kyle Stokes talked about, she got up to speak at that rally. I was like, sorry, we are going to do this. So I think that defied their expectations as well. I think they would agree that they wouldn't have expected her to go forward with that band.
So, I mean, if it's Garcia versus De Leon, I mean, those are two big names. De Leon, obviously a bigger name, but what do you think of that race, Alyssa?
It would sure be nice to have another woman on.
I don't know. I mean, I've now heard this from multiple people, and it is just rumor mongering. But on Twitter, when he was running for Senate, people, even like there was a GOP assemblywoman, Melissa Melendez, who was talking about this at the time. There's always been this rumor of some Me Too thing with Kevin De Leon. I don't know why it hasn't come out
substance. It is interesting. I mean, of course, there are a lot of factors to consider in terms of making an allegation like that public. But as you said, this is sort of something that has been whispered about De Leon back before even his Senate bid. And it was speculated that there might be some allegations to come out against Kevin De Leon last summer, or nothing really did. So, something might happen there.
And I'll just say, like, the vague allusions I've heard about him are related to dating in the office, things like of that nature, not like sexual assault or anything like that. So I just did not like launch like a vague allusion to that. But that's what has been happening with him. People will say like, but there's like this Me Too thing with Kevin De Leon. In this climate, it is dangerous to mention something like that. But I think it is interesting that it hasn't hasn't come out yet. Not that Dianne Feinstein needed to mention anything like that for her campaign. So maybe she just decided she didn't have to.
I mean, she also doesn't necessarily know how cell phones transmit information to the internet. So maybe she just didn't know how to get it out there.
Let's talk about the Metro Board was busy this week. We've talked about congestion pricing a lot. The Metro Board unanimously voted to go forward with a study of congestion pricing, how it would affect traffic in the city, how it would affect low-income people. At the same time, they're also going to study a tax on rideshare companies, Uber and Lyft especially, to basically see if they can get some of them off the road. I think it's kind of understood now that car share is not helping traffic.
Is not shared.
Yes.
We can't call it that. That's, you're playing into their marketing.
Okay, sorry. What should I call it?
Ride hailing.
Just
taxis. Like, they're just taxis.
Right.
They're not anything different than taxis.
I watched the Nathan For You episode last night where he, have you seen any of that show?
Yeah.
He did an episode where he was trying to help a struggling taxi company by turning a lot of taxi drivers into Uber drivers and having them be a sleeper cell where
I feel like that's actually happening. Don't
it does
you
seem like something that is happening in real life.
It would be effective. And he said, like, as soon as he gave the signal, they would become like very bad Uber drivers.
That's horrible.
I love that.
I love that. I also think it's horrible.
I would love to see him resurrect his dumb Starbucks bit for like a dumb Howard Schultz presidential campaign sort of thing.
Oh my God, remember that? Okay, I have so many thoughts about this, and the timing is very interesting. And there's one more part of the thing they're going to study is taxes on bike share scooters. And scooters. Yeah.
$1 per,
which is ridiculous,
vehicle.
Let's get back to that in a second. But the timing for this is very interesting because Lyft filed its IPO paperwork this week on Friday. So we are going to have pretty dramatic changes in the ride hailing or on-demand ride world pretty soon.
How does that affect people using Lyft?
Well, I don't think you'll notice much at first, as you'll say, but I think they have to now become profitable. They do not make money. These are not profitable companies. Our free and cheap rides have been subsidized by tech money for a decade. So I think these, but I also think what these companies are doing themselves are going to change the way that we get around on their own. I don't think we should be taxing Uber and Lyft. New York is doing the same thing. They introduced the same kind of structuring of a pricing structure for this idea to like tax them as a congestion pricing like type mechanism. So if you're going into the most congested parts of Manhattan, you'll pay more if you're in an Uber or a Lyft. Obviously, that will get passed on to you. So that's one way, I guess, to de-incentivize using these things. But also, isn't like price itself and traffic itself and all these things are going to start changing because of these companies are going to have to start changing because they, one, want to become profitable. Uber will go public, you know, soon as well, too. So they're going to need to offer different pricing structures to entice people to get out of that single car as well, right? Mm-hmm. So shared rides, they both offer like a discount on sharing rides. That will help get people to share rides, which is what we want. We want every ride to be shared. And then a really fascinating stat came out of Sacramento this week where Jump Bikes have been on the ground, which is owned by Uber, for
jump
6 months.
Jump Bikes are freestanding, just loose bikes.
Dockless, loose. I like loose. dockless electric bikes, which I think is very important. A company that was bought by Uber and is now operated by Uber. More people are taking rides on Jump Bikes than are using Uber's cars in downtown Sacramento.
More people are taking the bikes than using the cars.
Yeah. So trips, if you measure, look, I guess people is the wrong thing to say, trips. So a majority of trips are taken, people who fire up Uber's app, more people are choosing bikes than to get in a car.
Whoa.
That is because the bikes are everywhere. Mm-hmm. And because Sacramento has invested heavily in the infrastructure to make it safe to get around on bikes. They've added 22 miles of bike lanes over the last year and are adding like 30 more in the next year. Protected bike lanes, like really good ones. So this to me speaks to this opportunity that these ride hailing companies can provide. If you fire up your Lyft app or your Uber app now, you get scooters, you get bikes, you get shared rides, you get a regular ride. With Uber, you get also get like a caravan of SUVs that will take you anywhere in the city. I don't think Lyft has that, dude. Do they have like a black
Lyft,
car?
Black,
Lyft.
I don't think so.
No, Lyft has always pitched themselves as being like the less evil
version.
Yeah,
they're scrappy.
Of Uber. I think that the IPO thing is interesting. The initial public offering, as you were talking about, this is something that has been speculated about for as long as Lyft and Uber have been around. Uber is like basically burning money at rates that are unheard of in the history of any kind of corporate enterprise in the history of humankind. And definitely not profitable. And Lyft probably is not too different. So that Lyft is at least going public. Just to talk for a second about the way that the tech startup scene sort of works, we have basically people betting on the future profitability of companies, giving them a bunch of money in return for an expectation of future earnings. But eventually those people, those venture capitalists, do want to see some kind of return on their investment. So I imagine that's where we get the push for Lyft to go public and start actually making money back for people who have invested billions of dollars in it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Uber is not doing that, I assume, because they are just like being personally financed by Mohammed bin Salman as some kind of like lost leader for continued oil dependence for the rest of the century.
Well, let me ask. I assume that a lot of the reason why these companies aren't profitable is because they've been trying to expand so aggressively against each other for the last few years. Is it? I mean, I don't know if it's the model itself that is like the reason these companies are not profitable, except that it's kind of been a race to the bottom in terms of offering the cheapest ride. Also
they have to demonstrate growth.
Yes. And they just have to be growing constantly. And that won't change with an IPO.
No,
it might get worse.
And I think it's interesting that Lyft Well, they actually filed the preliminary paperwork on the same day last year in December or whatever.
Lyft and Uber did.
Yeah. So one of them was going to take this next step soon. But I think the thing about Lyft that is so interesting is that they have really partnered with cities from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like they have been a good partner. And you say, I mean, there's a range in that word, but they have been a good partner because they have worked really closely with cities, and they have worked like integrated with the public transit system in some situations. Like here in Santa Monica, if you get off the Expo line and it's after the hours when mm-hmm. the Big Blue Bus is running, you can use a Lyft code to like summon a vehicle.
Cool.
And take you home.
Yeah, like, that's cool.
They are part. And then they bought Motivate, which is the biggest bike share operator in the country. And now they basically operate City Bike, and they are pouring money into the expansion of City Bike in New York and all these other cities. So Lyft is like a part of our transportation system, like right. very, very mm-hmm. integrated into what we use every day. And they were the first to provide public transit directions in their app. And, you know, they're working really closely with all these bike share operators. So if one of them is going to quote unquote win,
yeah.
I think this is a better choice for us, because they get the public-private partnership a little bit better.
The sub-ideal thing about Lyft being that partner to me, though, is the necessity of a credit card, which Metro riders, for the most part, like don't have as much access to as drivers. So I wish that were a program. I mean, like lots of people have cell phones now, but a credit card is kind of a big hurdle.
Most of these places, all the scooter companies and bike companies, and I'm assuming rideshare companies have something like this too, but where you can use a code and you can do like a prepay card thing, even if you don't have a credit card. You can do like a prepay.
You can buy it somewhere at a store somewhere.
I think you can just get it. I mean, with Lime, this is really getting into too much detail, but I think with some of the scooter companies, you just get a card. They send you a card and you just use a code to unlock it. And you can do like a... how you like pay, what's it called? Where you like,
you have like a credit and
you have like, yeah, you can yeah. just like go somewhere and pay cash or something and you can like load it up. But Metro has that too, right? You don't need a credit card to get a tap card.
No, but there are machines that you can go to right. get it. And you can even get it like yeah. when you are riding the bus.
But I think you could probably, we'll ask that, but yeah, okay. No, now this is getting too complicated.
but I think it's worth it just because like, you know, I think you always got to go back to like, that what's the average, Scott, the income for a transit rider and for a Metro rider in LA?
For train, average household income is $19,000 annual. For bus, it's $15,000 annual.
Yeah. And most of them don't have cars as well. So it's people right. that are, this is like yeah. their only
option. It's not
option.
Ideal, of yeah. course. But I think we should note that if we want them.
If it's between Lyft and Uber,
But also like
absolutely.
Cities are already making Lyft and Uber part of their decision, this decision making. So
No hashtag delete Lyft. So that should tell you everything you need to.
Yes, that's a good
yeah,
point.
Yeah, no, between the two of them, for sure.
Yeah, so it will be interesting to see what happens. I think the big takeaway here is that the way that we have seen ride-hailing companies be basically subsidized by private capital, in part, that's going to change. And I think it's important that cities like LA are starting to think about enforcing in some way a more realistic cost of actually doing business. I think from the company's perspective, it makes a lot of sense, like you were saying, Hayes, to subsidize to the maximum limit possible the cost of a ride. Uber has been very open about the fact that they want to get everybody else bankrupt out of this mm-hmm. space so that they can have 100% of the market capture. But I do think that from the perspective of cities and the public, it makes an equal amount of sense to say, we're not going to let you do that, because then you're just flooding the streets with cars.
Yes.
And you're making people take trips that otherwise would not have taken place. And they're doing so by car instead of walking or
right.
whatever.
But the fact that they own these bike and scooter companies now really complicates it, because we can't.
Would those be affected by the tax?
Well, but they also want to tax bikes and scooters. So it's like my proposal, Metro Board, if you're listening, or whoever else out there,
they're listening,
is do everything you can to make it cheap and easy to ride bikes and scooters. If you want to tax cars, don't necessarily tax Uber and Lyft, tax all cars. Great, car is a car. The most traffic is generated by people who are not Uber and Lyft drivers, think it is.
Well, no, obviously more cars on the road are not Uber and Lyft drivers, but the average Uber and Lyft driver is basically driving, well, is generating a lot more traffic than a single driver.
Haven't studied it. That's a good thing to study.
Well,
they should study.
The numbers I've seen from the studies that have been done, I think we've talked about this on the show, say that the ratio of when you hail,
like deadheading. Yeah.
Yes. Deadheading and actually driving with a passenger. It's 1-to-1.
Right.
Basically.
And so if you drive yourself somewhere, you're looking for parking, I guess, a little bit.
Right.
But it doesn't make up for just the guy circling around waiting for
right. But that's why we should,
Donald
should
Shoup
say.
Donald Shoup is going to burst through the wall.
He's like, did someone need me? But I think that's why, sorry, I've been like so mad about this from the beginning, because how do you get people to share rides, right?
Yeah.
Like you make it, you incentivize it, you make it cheaper or easier. So why would we tax, you know, there's got to be something in there that says we will not tax you at all if you're taking a shared
ride.
That's what we want.
Yep.
And then the bike and scooter thing, why would we add more taxes and make it harder to use these vehicles that are not cars? Like, this is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. So speaking of which, one of our esteemed city council members this week, and this seems to keep happening, doesn't always stick, but instituted a scooter ban on his district. This is council member Gil Cedillo in the first council district that covers kind of Eagle Rock, Highland Park, over to like El Sereno area, I think, and also Dodger Stadium, notably. He said no more scooters in his neighborhood. What was the reasoning that he gave for that?
No good reason.
Really,
who cares? Yeah, it's a horrible idea.
It's basically Cedillo has been actively opposed to street safety improvements. He actually, I think last year or maybe the year before, mm-hmm. Directed LADOT not to do any like bike lanes projects or anything in CD1 without his like express
no
approval.
Road diets, no bike lanes, no like safety improvements, basically,
which is wild that got the blessing of the city council, or that they are taking any part in those administrative actions. In this case, again, I assume that it is some misdirected hand waving about street safety improvements being actually unsafe for road users.
Well, so this the Expo Line Ledger Twitter account, which I normally like, because all my news about the Expo Line from them, tweeted something about like, I can see how after a Dodger game, like people that have like had a few too many getting on a scooter and like weaving around traffic could be like kind of dangerous. And of course, instinctively, I was just like, imagine if they were allowed to get in a car. The most knee jerk sanctimonious.
I think you said something on Twitter, Scott, which is what it's just wild that we can have all these different council districts that can just decide, in my district, there will be no road diets and no scooters. I am sorry. Like, doesn't work for me. I mean, that is outrageous.
Yeah, no, I would say like fundamentally at odds with like the notion of actually governing a city, right? Like you're going to take an arbitrarily drawn, like basically just gerrymandered stretch of the city, and you're going to say, within these lines, I am king. I will do whatever I want. Yes. If you want road diets, hitch a ride over to CD14
to another
get the hell out. So that was what my thought was when I was seeing this. It does seem like Cedillo might have overreached here, and Mike Bonin, who chairs the transportation committee, is saying that any changes to this to the approved pilot that was voted on by the full city council would have to go back through the committee system again. Okay. So we pretty much don't know what the fallout of this would yeah. be, but we do know that there are at least a handful of council members who are actively opposed to having any sort of e-bikes or scooter share or anything like that in their districts. If it's a sizable enough block, they can probably circumvent what we would expect to be a normal operating procedure, which right. is unfortunate, really.
Related to this, I know Mitch O'Farrell and Mitch Englander banned, at least temporarily, scooters in their districts. I live pretty close to Mitch O'Farrell's district. It doesn't really seem to have taken. There are scooters around there. Did that not go through?
It was just the first maybe like draft information that got sent to the scooter and bike companies before their RFPs were due. So okay. I don't think that they're
that didn't last.
You can look at the map and right. see there are no drop zones. You could look at it, like the data is updated all the time, but I'm pretty sure that has changed
got
because
it.
They're still in Englander's district, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. Related to how we drive around.
It's not his district anymore. What am I saying?
Anymore. Yeah.
No, hey, we could, instead of two Mitches, we could have two Monicas on the city council.
Oh, hey.
Wow.
His district is like the free space in bingo at the moment.
More interesting driving news. LA is changing. This has been a few years in the making. LA is changing how we measure traffic, basically, in the city. In 2013, Jerry Brown passed a state law that said that when you do environmental analysis for what's called CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, you measure traffic and congestion based on something called level of service.
Yeah.
That's like the metric.
Right.
What does level of service involve?
This is like Scott's whole life leads up to answering this question.
Yeah, actually. Level of service is like, I think if you think about the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, how mm-hmm. they're like building the freeway, the 101 through Toontown, Hollywood. Level of service is a traffic engineering measurement that says how fast can we get every car imaginable through a given mm-hmm. geographical point. So like in the post-war era, post-World War II, this was an emerging discipline, traffic engineering, where we were seeing basically roads redesigned so that they could funnel all the cars possible past a point as fast as possible. Anything that slowed down cars was bad, and they gave it a letter grade.
And bad, in this case, for the environment is basically what they're saying.
Yes.
Like a higher level of service, being able to get cars through an area faster
yeah.
is better under CEQA.
Yeah. So we have, basically a paradigm where we're saying anything that moves cars faster, good. Idling cars, bad in a number of ways. And so you have grades of A through F gradually over time. Of course, every intersection in the city of LA has become graded about E or F. And anything that changes the CEQA laws that are in place currently assume that the status quo is good, and
yep.
that changing the status quo, you basically have to look at, if you're looking at level of service, are we going to increase the amount of time that it would take cars to go through this intersection by like 5 seconds or more? If so, that's bad. It gets
right.
an F. And so this is basically something that requires roads to be widened so that more cars can pass through. It requires bike lanes and things like that not be put in.
Yeah.
We're basically just saying, how can we make a road as much as possible like a freeway? And,
yes.
and that's really the only consideration.
And it's a great metric for if you're putting up an apartment building in a neighborhood or something for like local residents who say like, well, there's going to be more cars going through here, so there's going to be more traffic, so it's going to be bad for the environment. Mm-hmm. This metric would support them in that argument. That is changing. LA is starting the process of changing this, as all California cities are, by July 1st, 2020. Level of service is dead. They will no longer be using that metric. Now it's just vehicle miles traveled. There was an article about this on Urbanize LA by Stephen Sharp that I thought articulated this well. And he says, rather than treating traffic congestion faced by drivers as an environmental impact, this new metric instead considers the act of driving itself as the environmental impact. So now any change that you make to the streetscape, any new building that you put up is going to be measured by how many cars it puts on the road and for how long, whether it increases or decreases the driving that people do.
Yeah.
Which if you assume that the act of driving itself is what puts carbon emissions in the air, is a lot better for the environment than what we've
been
doing
historically. There's still some people that don't believe that, I think. but this is it mirrors very well what we were talking about earlier with what you would tax for driving. So mm-hmm. a VMT tax is an interesting way to approach something like this, the symmetry of like the built environment and the emissions and, you know, charging cars to hopefully get them to not be on the road as much. So it all goes together.
Yep. And you would think this would make a pretty big difference when it comes to reducing the 40% of emissions in the state of California that come from transportation and things like that.
And specifically, if you know you're going to build a building and you want to reduce this, you might not put in like 8 floors of parking as part of your development. Or maybe you would, if you were in charge of a neighborhood that was close to like a train station.
This is a great segue.
If you had a light rail line that was in your district and you were one of these tiny kings of LA, yes. of the city of LA, and you wanted to make the city carbon neutral by 2025.
Yeah. And you are essentially one of the most environmentally conscious council members.
I would say
you're actually, we're talking about Paul Koretz here. He's the only council member who is concerned about what we're doing with the waste in terms of carpet being pulled out from City Hall. I think it's fair to say that he cares a lot about our environment on that basis alone.
This is a great segue to talking about Paul Koretz, the council member who represents a lot of the West Side, Westwood, Bel Air, up into Encino and the richer parts of the valley. Has come out against SB 50, which we've talked about on the show now a couple times, which is the new version of SB 827, which would increase density along transit lines and also in job-rich areas. And in the new version would carve out economically sensitive areas and not build as much in them. Paul Koretz does not represent a lot of economically sensitive areas.
I wouldn't know it by hearing him talk about his district, though.
And so he has come out in opposition of Senate Bill 50. He has actually filed a motion to have Los Angeles, the entire city, be exempt from Senate Bill 50. He is concerned that tall, narrow, 4 to 5 story buildings will tower over single family homes until they are squeezed out. This sounds like a physical.
And I'm trying
process,
to envision
like
what
pimple.
That looks like. Yeah, I mean, I don't understand.
He said that the SB 50 doesn't respect the character of single family neighborhoods. In the same statement, Jill Stewart, as part of the Coalition to Preserve LA, said that Scott Wiener, who's been a guest on the show and is putting forward Senate Bill 50, has a dystopian version of the growth of California cities, and that his bill seeks to end the world of yards.
Honestly, I am listening to everything you just said, Koretz and Jill Stewart, and I agree, and I think it's great. It's fantastic. Good. No more yards.
Keep going, though. There's more. No
also,
more yards.
No more yards. No more single-family homes. No more tree-lined streets. I did not know that was part of the bill, but apparently that is illuminating. And no more places for children to thrive. And actually on that, I agree. I do not think Scott Wiener should have put in the bill that children are no longer allowed to
That's
thrive
unfortunate language.
Near transit stations.
A children thriving density bonus. specifically targeting that.
I was listening to Gimme Shelter, Liam Dillon and Matt Levin, podcast, also a former guest on the show. And they talked to this guy, Yonah Freemark, an MIT student, who wrote a study recently that has been kind of earth-shaking in the urban planning world, about how in Chicago, they upzoned a lot of Chicago near transit stops. And the effect of it was not really what people wanted. First of all, they didn't really build new housing near the transit stops. And the value of those properties went up, as you would expect, because you can build more units on any parcel of land. That's not a surprise, but it didn't translate into new building. And I was like, oh, this is like pretty bad. Like, what does this mean for SB 50? And he was suggesting that we should put forward a lot of incentives to build and to build affordably at the same time as we're loosening zoning restrictions. But the thing that really struck me about it is it was about raising like 5-story buildings to like 7 stories, which is so different
from what
we are facing in this city.
We'll never get there.
I mean, yeah, no, I think it makes intuitive sense that there are a very specific set of circumstances in which you could take an existing 5-story building that is already serving as housing for people, multiple families, and change it to a 7-story building and have that be a worthwhile financial endeavor. On the contrary, in, for instance, CD5, Paul Koretz's district, the by household richest district in the entire city, we have a majority of those residents being single family homes, where it would be extremely profitable to turn a one family residence into one that could potentially house 100 families and some of the most valuable real estate in the entire country.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I do think this was kind of a study that was very important. And at the same time, as so often happens with housing, it kind of turned into this, everybody just reads
confirming
and,
their priors, no matter what,
at all costs.
But I think Yonah said this too in subsequent interviews and pieces too, but you can't just do one thing. You have to do a lot of things, and we're not doing any of those things.
Yes.
I mean, and we have right now the plan around the Expo Line stations that I was alluding to before, which passed with some provisions taken out from the council member because they were still doing too much squeezing of the single family homes. And then we're going to have, yes, we have some pretty good, like, affordable housing things in place with like the TOC guidelines and things like that. But we cannot just sit here and fight everything that comes our way. And that is a fairly good idea, I think, and had built upon a lot of the problems that 827 had. Mm-hmm. And for him to try to take this hard line so early on, I mean, I'm surprised no other council member has come out kind of on the other side. Because they all.
I wouldn't say I'm surprised by that.
No, sorry,
either.
No, I'm not. I meant to say the opposite. I'm surprised that we haven't already had this started to see this discussion. Because as you remember, it was a unanimous vote to say we don't like 827 from the city council. This is going to be a huge fight, and it's going to be a fight up and down the state. So
would like to see it. And I'm sure I will not get this wish, but if it's going to be a fight within the city council, if there are some council members, your Mike Bonins, who are traditionally like a little more housing friendly, who might be more amenable to SB 50 in its new form,
that carves out these neighborhoods.
Yes.
I mean, I agree.
I would love to see that fight happen in the open. I would love to see my political representatives debate these issues.
Yes, exactly. Instead of just shutting it down.
Only multiple times a week, there were some kind of like forum where they were all sitting behind a big table.
I love how we're only speaking in hypotheticals. But I will mention, for the environmental angle, several large environmental groups, including NRDC, came out pro SB 50 this week,
which actually provides a considerable amount of cover for politicians to take a stance. I don't know that we necessarily will see that yet. I don't really feel like there's a reason to. Koretz is Kretz is staking out such a hard line in the opposite direction because it's kind of a known thing that he's going to oppose this regardless of what form it takes. There's nothing that could happen that would change his stance.
Which is why he has come out with a fully formed opinion about it as it's like in its first form instead of waiting until it goes through committee and is inevitably changed substantially. Yeah. He's not suggesting any changes to it. He is saying exclude LA from this narrative entirely.
Which is kind of like
a sensitive community of Los Angeles.
Yes. they are the most sensitive community in this respect, for sure.
He's basically taking like the diehard hostage takers approach to politicking. Also, he doesn't really have that much power or say here. I think, if anything, Kretz's very, very unreasonable hardline stance is probably related to the fact that we will see some council members like Mike Bonin, for one, be more amenable to the current form of the bill. And he's kind of going to be on his own here. Not on his own.
I don't know. I mean, I'm
certainly not part of the unanimous.
It would have been a good foray for Weezer to come forward, but that density argument is a little complicated now.
I think we should build more. He's no longer on the committee, so
yeah. It's weird to have someone like he begins his statement, Kretz, saying we all agree that we need to build more affordable housing, particularly near transit.
I don't think his district agrees with that at all.
I think he should check with his district about that. But if that's the case, there must be a way to suggest a reform to the current version of Senate Bill 50 that you would approve of. It's pretty close to the thing that you say you want.
Well, remember when we interviewed State Senator Scott Wiener, who is behind both these bills, and he told us that the council member did not even admitted to not reading
having not read
827. So maybe he hasn't read this one either yet.
Yeah, because he also said in this. Oh yeah, he said that
he says that there's like tricks. The rest of his statement was that there are like tricks, and it's in this bill, and it's worded in a way that it won't just be five stories; it will be many more stories.
He says that actually, many analysts are saying that the five story number is a minimum.
Yeah, you could just read it, and it would just say
an infinite
many analysts.
Facts of them.
Oh my god.
Okay, that's all. That's all we got for this week. We're done. We'll be back next week. I'm going to Vancouver, which is where they are building a lot of new condos and stuff, and
have more people riding transit than using their.
That's true.
Cars,
and it's still very expensive to live there, and it hasn't necessarily worked. So I will report back on the results of what CD5 will look like. One year
instead
from
of
now.
Dubai, just Vancouver,
and we'll do that next week. Bye.